Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, October 16th, 2007 Carrboro Board of Aldermen meeting. I would like to begin this evening's meeting by recognizing the manager for a few comments.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor, members of the board. I'd like to welcome tonight a number of members from our fire department and police department. I'm really proud of all of our town employees. I think we have a great organization, and all of our employees do a great job of delivering services to our community. But on September 30th of this year, our police department and our fire department really were involved in a number of acts of bravery on behalf of this community and did an outstanding job in dealing with a very, very serious and deadly fire on September 30th at the Highland Hills apartment. I knew when I got a call from Chief Crabtree at 2:30 in the morning on Sunday morning that he wasn't calling to say good morning. And he let me know at that early hour that it was a very serious situation, and then we had a couple more conversations during the night and with one of the captains later in the morning. This is not at all about me. This is about the brave work of our police departments and fire departments. Our police department arrived first on scene, kicked in doors, got people out quickly before the fire department was on scene, and the fire apparently had been burning for some time before we received notification of the fire. So I wanted to take a chance tonight to introduce these folks to you all. I don't know if Chief Crabtree or Chief Hutchison have any comments they'd like to make, but I'd like to ask members of the police department and fire departments to stand and be recognized, and I'd like to say thank you all very, very much for the work that you do for this community, and especially the work that you did on September 30th.
I know, Steve, I appreciate your remarks, and I'm not sure that I'm in a better position to say anything beyond what you've said, but I know we're a community that's tremendously proud of both our police department and our fire department, and you know, it was one of those critical moments when as bad as things went, they could have been far worse. And we really, I know the entire board is really proud of the pace of the response and the bravery that members of both departments showed in confronting the situation. And I think we're also at the same time saddened that there was loss of life in the situation. But I think we know that there was certainly nothing that our fire department or our police department could possibly have done to have prevented that from happening. And we're really proud of you, and we thank you for not only for the work that you did on this past September 30th, but for the work that you do every day to protect our community. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I would just also like to share for the board of the town of Carrboro our deepest condolences to the family and friends of Gloria Suarez. I only knew Gloria briefly. We ran into each other often grocery shopping, and it's a loss that the entire community feels, and I want to be sure that the family and friends of Gloria realize that we offer our condolences, our deepest condolences for her tragic passing.
I just want to add one thing to that. I also knew Gloria only in passing, but I want to share something that was in the Chapel Hill news article about her death that I think speaks very powerfully for the kind of person she is and what a loss this is to the community. Ann Henley of her church said, "Gloria was a bridge builder between cultures, between language groups, and between people of all kinds, and she was especially interested in the poor and children." And you know, any loss is a loss for all of us, but Gloria clearly was a very special person, and an important part of the community.
All right. And tangentially on this topic, let me say I understand it's been brought to my attention that apparently this Friday night, October 19th, there will be a benefit concert at the Cat's Cradle for residents of Highland Hills who lost their homes and possessions, and that'll be 7:30 this Friday night, featuring Sweet By and By, Harmute, Birds and Arrows, and Puritan Rodeo at the event. So hope that people can make it out and help support the folks who have lost so much in that fire. Thank you all. With that, I would like to turn at this point to I didn't see Carly Apple here, but is Carly Apple here tonight? Okay, if not, we'll proceed onward. Our we have various people signed up to speak on matters that are on our agenda. There's one sign up for a matter that is not on our agenda. So I would like to, at this point, recognize, is there a representative from the Martinez family who would like to come up to the podium and speak to us?
It's a great honor for us. You know, we lost a dear child of us in this conflict that we have overseas. And we've been so same time delightful to all the efforts everybody been doing close to our family to still keeping that flame alive of our sons. And to the point they also dedicate one of those adopt the highway in memory of Staff Sergeant Michelle Martinez. And as I close by the house, and every day I pass by, I kind of say hello. And now in this time, they were invited on this special occasion. The name of Martinez family and the family from Texas said thank you very much for your support. God bless you all.
Thank you, Senor.
Just for the folks here, our last board meeting, two boards ago, was announced that the process for the naming of the new high school has started, and it's required that all members of the community give feedback and input on naming it. The Martinez family, friends approached me to consider one of the names, to name the school after Mrs. Staff Sergeant Isabel Martinez, and so they, I believe, Congressman Price office sent them here, so I told them they were more than welcome to come. So I'm glad we're doing this.
We all appreciate hearing some feedback on this issue. The town of Carver is going to have some influence on the question of what name to give to the school. Although ultimately there's a committee that will make a recommendation to the school board or a couple of recommendations to the school board, and the school board will make the ultimate decision. But we will certainly take the comments from tonight's meeting into account in participating in that process, and we're glad to have you all join us tonight, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we will turn to our consent agenda, Mr. Manager.
Okay. Item 1 is approval of the minutes of the previous meeting, October 2nd. Item 2 is a request to approve a resolution for the issuance of $2,590,000 in sidewalk bond anticipation notes. Item 3 is a town code amendment to change the speed limit on a portion of North Greensboro Street. Item 4, appointments to the Board of Adjustment. Item 5 is a request to set a public hearing on an ordinance amending the Carborough Land Use Ordinance to modify site distance requirements. Item 6 is a request to set a public hearing on an ordinance amending the Carborough Land Use Ordinance to allow limited retail and office uses in the WM3 district. Item 7 is a resolution authorizing the town manager to enter into an agreement with the North Carolina Department of Transportation to perform bridge inspections. Item 8 is a request to set joint planning public hearings and assembly of government meeting dates for 2008.
Move the items.
Second.
Okay, the items have been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The matter passes unanimously. Mr. Manager, we are on item D1.
Okay. Item D1 is a review of the affordable housing for the Roberson Square mixed-use building conditional use permit project. Because the Roberson Square mixed-use building project has not committed to reserving 15% of its units as affordable, Section 15-54.1 of the Land Use Ordinance requires that the applicant participate in an affordable housing review meeting with the Board of Aldermen before project review may continue. At this time, the Board of Aldermen is asked to review the affordable housing component of the Roberson Square project. And I believe, Marty, we don't have a staff presentation. The applicant is here to have that conversation with the board.
Good evening. My name is Julia Young. I'm an attorney with Bernstein and Presnell in Raleigh, and here on behalf of Darcon, who is the developer of the Roberson Square project. As submitted, and I'll give limited background and certainly welcome questions if you have any as to the background and status of this matter, but as submitted in November 2006, the Roberson Square project is a mixed-use facility, including condominiums. The plan itself submitted included 18 units, three of which on the plan would be designated as affordable, and three of which would be the bonus units for those three affordable units. Otherwise, under the residential density ordinances, it would be eligible for a 12-unit approval for the plan. At this time, we are coming before the board to request that it consider a payment in lieu for two of those three units. It is my understanding from discussions with both the town attorney and from some of the planning personnel that that those payments in lieu would not equate to also allowing us to maintain the bonus units. And I'll address that matter secondarily, but want to talk to you a moment about why we believe the payment in lieu makes sense in this particular situation. Unlike residential subdivisions where there are homes per lot, this is a one-building condominium where the first and second floors will not be residential and only the third, fourth, and fifth floors as presented would be. It is one building where the exterior can't be modified in ways to decrease the costs by the developer. And so some of those costs for building units are assumed whether the unit is affordable versus whether it is a market rate unit. And so those costs don't necessarily change. But the primary reason for asking for payment in lieu on this project is because of the maintenance and homeowners association fees associated with the project. Unlike with townhomes or residential subdivisions, condominium associations are required by the law to maintain the insurance policies, both general liability and homeowners risk policies, as the primary insurer for the homeowner. And because of that, we anticipate that the homeowner's dues per unit will be at a minimum $300 per month, which, when taken in light of the fact that they will be affordable home units, becomes a significant part of the homeowner's income per month. Those are set primarily by the insurance companies and aren't. And certainly there is additional cost in the homeowner's dues to assume maintenance and things of that nature. But the primary component of those dues will be whatever the insurance policy premium is and isn't adjustable by the developer. Further, the developer won't maintain a relationship with the condominium owners association once it is finished building and the homeowners themselves will take over for that process. But that's the primary reason that we would seek a payment in lieu in this situation. It's my understanding that this is a relatively new policy that was just recently adopted. And in fact, there isn't at this time, unless it's happened in the past day or two, any guidance formally that's been adopted by this board for the developer to determine what exactly that payment in lieu would be. We certainly understand there's a calculation set by the statute, but those average subsidies weren't available prior to hearing, so we would reserve the right to reject the payment in lieu, assuming that you were willing to do that, depending on what that amount would be. We're anticipating, based on prior conversations, that it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $85,000 to $90,000 per unit. We have talked with Orange County Land Trust, and Robert Dowling is here tonight, and without speaking on his behalf, I presume he's certainly willing to answer any questions that you have. In trying to figure out what the best way to meet both the policy's goals and the developer's needs as well, to provide the 15% affordable housing requirement. And in doing so, the payment in lieu would provide Orange County Land Trust with means to provide the subsidies necessary not only for this first unit that the developer would be building or willing to build, but also to provide additional subsidies necessary for previously approved affordable housing under other plans where subsidy money will be needed and there are insufficient funds already to meet those needs. Because of the type of project, this isn't, as I mentioned, a residential development where there are lots that we could, as a developer, consider to reserve for the town by way of donation. That's simply not an option when you're talking about a condominium project. So the only two options available to this developer are to build the three affordable housing units and to reserve them for affordable use long-term and hope that whoever ends up in those projects can find subsidies to meet those ongoing monthly maintenance dues or to set aside monies through the land trust or other entities to do that. The second part of what I want to talk with you about is the incentive portion of what was adopted. If what I understand is correct, there is very little incentive to the developer here in a payment in lieu situation where the board perhaps would not allow the bonus units. And we're asking you to consider, and I'll, to the extent you would like me to, go through the ordinances to suggest to you that I think you're allowed to, as they are written, to allow the two bonus units in addition to the payment in lieu. And such that it would be not an 18-unit facility, but a 14-unit facility that would allow one affordable housing with the matching market rate unit, and then two payments in lieu with two matching market rate units. When this policy came to the board for adoption, the planning board also attached a recommendation trying in an attempt to set some parameters and urging that these ordinances be modified to allow those parameters, and in fact they were not adopted by the board, and so I think it is within the board's authority, if it should elect to do so, to allow the bonus units to also be built and accept the payments in lieu. Without doing so, the builder is simply paying you and getting no incentive for it. And I think that defeats the purpose of an incentive plan. Without stating too much of the obvious, the payment in lieu title itself would seem to suggest that it is in lieu of something, and the statutory language seems to also suggest that if the payment in lieu is made, it meets the affordable housing requirement, which would suggest that it should be allowed to also qualify for the bonus unit. The in lieu means instead of something, and that in this instance would be instead of building the actual unit. The developer is prepared to do that and also prepared to hear any other ideas that the board would have, if it has any. But that we're here tonight to ask you to consider to accept a payment in lieu on two of those three affordable units, and in addition to allow the bonus units to be made, to be built for those payments in lieu. I'm happy to answer any questions or sit down and be quiet.
I'd be real interested in hearing our attorney's response to the client's attorney, to the developer's attorney.
I think, as we've had discussions previously, that may be a commendable objective, but it's not what the ordinance says. The ordinance right now, in my interpretation and judgment, says that you're entitled to get the bonus units for providing the affordable housing. It must be recalled the basis upon which the affordable housing payments in lieu provisions were created was to sort of fill in the gaps to deal with a situation that particularly in when you have a small number of units, in order to get the 15%, the numbers don't work out exactly right. You may have, it's the difference between, say, providing three units or four units. And so if four might be 20%, three might be 14% or something like that. So to get to the 15, you had to provide one extra unit, and those, the concept that was raised, well, how about making an allowing our payment to get so you have the 15%? Again, it might, if the board chooses it, would require only an amendment to the ordinance to make it possible to have a payment be made and get the bonus units in lieu of actually providing them. That's a choice you can certainly make, but it's not the one that's in the ordinance now as I read it.
If I could add, I mean, that's right. That all the discussions we had over the year that I met with staff, and I think the ordinance that came before us was exactly as Mike's describing it, that we were really looking at those fractional units, and it never came up, this idea that there were issues with condominiums and that there might be some much broader use of payments in lieu to address that. And so I think Mike's right that the ordinance does not allow what's being requested specifically as it's written.
Joel and Alex, we actually have one person signed up to speak too, but...
Okay. I guess my question to you as the representative of the developer, if you anticipate that the monthly cost will be $300 a month for the condo, how would you make the argument if two people can't afford that $300 a month? How can one person afford the $300 a month?
Well, one person probably can't, but the subsidy that is going to Orange County Land Trust would then be available to help assist in making that payment when that subsidy isn't necessarily otherwise available readily. There are funds and trusts and other government grants that can be sought, but as I understand it, those simply will not be sufficient to meet the demands of the projects that have already been approved.
No, but I guess my question is, if the assumption is that whatever person would buy into an affordable condo that's developed, why would you expect one to be able to pay the $300 when the assumption is because of the insurance and the monthly cost, then anybody could do it if they're purchasing an affordable? Is it your assumption that the subsidy that you provide would go to the resident who would be living in the one condo?
Our assumption is not that. Our assumption is the subsidy would go direct to Orange County Land Trust or whatever other entity that this board would like it to be received by. If the board would be interested in us designating it specifically to do that, we would certainly be willing to do that as well. But our assumption is not that it would be done in that manner, but would be a more general subsidy.
This is somewhat along the lines of the same topic, and maybe Robert can answer this question. The underpinning behind your argument is centering around the expense of homeowners association dues. There have been other projects in other necks of the woods, shall we say, who have run into this issue in dealing with the provision of affordable units and how the homeowners association dues are handled. And there was an arrangement in Greenbridge that was put together which provides a differential cost structure for the affordable units. Robert, can you describe for us how that arrangement works? I don't remember how that got set up. Can you tell us about it? And maybe you can educate these folks in how that worked? Yeah.
Good evening. Robert Dowling from Orange Community Housing Land Trust. Greenbridge did two things to enable those units to be affordable. First, on the amount of the monthly assessments, there's two ways it can be done. It's either by square footage, pro rata square footage, or by value. The statute, I believe, allows for either one. And our units were valued at so much lower than the market rate units that they went with the value. And that brought our rates, our monthly assessments down. The second mechanism they used was the transfer fee, that all the market rate units pay a 1% transfer fee. And that transfer fee is self-generating subsidy to keep the affordable units affordable virtually forever. And I've done the numbers for 30 years, and those units will remain affordable no matter what. So those are two mechanisms that were used by Greenbridge to enable those condominiums to be affordable.
So that's a 1% transfer fee that's essentially written in as a restrictive covenant, correct? Or as a deed restriction, rather?
It's written into their CUP.
Right.
And it's written into the declaration of condominium.
Right. And that 1%, transfer fee kicks in each time a unit turns over, which is how the thing provides an ongoing revenue stream, right?
Correct.
And Robert, in your estimation, would that model work for a project like this, like the one that's before us?
I haven't done the numbers. I suspect it would work.
Okay. And have you shared this structure with the developer?
I don't recall.
Well, I was assuming that he hadn't, because the attorney didn't, developer's representative didn't mention it.
And
so I would suggest that obviously we're going to hear from other folks about it, but that the sort of first next step in the discussions about this issue should be that the applicant should explore this mechanism as the way to skin this particular cat, depending on, of course, the board's preference, but given the restrictions that are placed on us by the ordinance that we adopted deliberately, as Dan pointed out, that the payment in lieu scheme that is being asked for by the applicant really doesn't work within the ordinance structure or the policy that we've set forth. So what we're doing is offering you some help here.
Sure. If you don't mind, if I ask you one question.
Sure.
Is the transfer tax only as to the affordable units,
no,
or is it as...
It's not a tax. It's actually a fee, which is written into the deed restrictions of the unit.
Units?
Yeah, and so it's all internal. What happens is that the market rate units, every time that they turn over time, that 1% goes back into the kitty. Is the kitty in the form of a trust fund, or how's that work?
It's managed by the homeowners
association, right.
I think, is what's notable about it.
Right.
But in any case, it's all internal. The town doesn't have anything to do with it. Robert doesn't have anything to do with it. That's just an internal mechanism that's used to provide an ongoing stream of funding.
And it's the maintenance
to keep the units
affordable. Right, maintenance of the affordable units.
We have one other speaker who's signed up to speak on this. If now would be a good time for that, maybe. Robert actually has signed up, actually, so there are two. But I don't know whether
if you wouldn't mind,
go right ahead since you're up there.
I come at this from a different perspective.
that a developer does, as you all know. I wrote you a letter. You had it your places, and I'm once again suggesting you consider payment in lieu. And it's unfortunate the ordinance may not allow that. I think that's unfortunate. And my perspective is different from the developer's. I'm looking at, and I don't come back to you with a payment in lieu option a month after you rejected it with Alberta to annoy you. I don't do that. I come to you because I think it's the right thing to do. I'm aware of the 182 units that have been approved in Hillsboro, Carrboro, and Chapel Hill that are coming to the land trust between 2008 and 2011, 182 units, 106 of which are condominiums. I'm aware of the constraints on a six-person organization and handling that kind of volume, and I'm aware of the projected subsidy we're going to need, and I only gave you the Carrboro subsidy, which is more than $1 million, and I'm aware of the amounts of subsidy that are available. There's no one in this room or in this county that wants inclusionary housing to be successful more than me. I can assure you of that. I want to work. And I come to you recommending you consider a payment in lieu because I have very grave concerns about how this is going to work over the next several years. And if you want us to do the three units, we will go forward and try and sell those three units. But I'll be coming back to you all in 2008, in 2009, 2010, looking for substantial amounts of subsidy. And you all don't control very much money that you can give me. But I will need it to make it work. So that's why I recommend payment in lieu. And I've had people say to me out on the street, Robert, why is it I read in the paper that you don't want affordable housing downtown? You want developers to get let off the hook and get to be able to pay their way out of it. And boy, I wish I could write an editorial in one of the local newspapers to explain myself. I've thought about it. I understand this better than anybody does. I'm not bragging on myself. This is what I do. And I want it to work. And a payment in lieu, to me, is a very viable option to provide the sources of money that are going to be needed over time. That's the angle I come at it from. Very different from the developer. So with that, I'll stop. And I'll happily do whatever you all want us to do.
Robert,
go ahead. Robert, given what the affordable units would cost in the building, in the proposed development, what income bracket would you then have to sell to? Who would be your customers if we put you in a position where you had to sell those? Who would be your likely customers who could afford those affordable units?
Well, I haven't had my spreadsheet with me. Have a spreadsheet, we'll travel. And if the developer agrees to sell us the unit for $75,000, which is well below his cost, the developer will take a very big loss for every unit that he sells to us, $75,000. We will still need $17,000 to bring it down to $58,000 to sell to a single person at 70% of the median income. Now, your requirement, your policy is 80%. But if it's priced right at 80%, you can't sell it to anybody because you need to make 80 to qualify, but you can't make more than 80 or else you're over. So you have to price this at 70. 70 is about $34,500.
For a single person.
For a single person.
So who would that be?
The maximum is $39,950. So we'd be selling it, to answer your question, Jackie, to whoever we sold it to. It would be someone between $34,500 and
$39,950. For a single person making that income?
Single person making that amount of money. There are teachers in that range.
Right.
And there are people who work at the university and a hospital in that range. But that is a very narrow range.
So there could be a lot of, like, young professionals or people just getting out of graduate school or people who we could expect to make more money during the course of their career.
I expect most of them to be sold to young people. It'll be so, and I believe it'll be transitional,
right,
in terms of people stay there while they're young and single until they're maybe not so single.
Robert,
that's transitional as well.
The pitch you made in terms of the funding you need and the payments in lieu, Does that contradict the idea that the Greenbridge model is workable? That, in other words, that gets us out of that predicament for units where that's applied, if it's truly, as Alex described it, self-funding. And as you said, you went out 30 years on that.
So. It resolves the subsidy problem.
Okay.
It does not resolve the capacity problem for the organization or the gap, the window of eligible buyers. It could address the window. If there's enough subsidy generated, you could widen the window with that self-generated subsidy. It does not address the demand for one-bedroom condominiums or the capacity of the organization to sell 106 one- and two-bedroom condominiums. But it does address the need for subsidy. We won't need any public subsidy at Greenbridge ever.
Mark, I had a question.
Yeah.
Robert, so is this question of homeowners association dues, I mean, this is going to be an ongoing question, isn't it?
Yes.
So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if we change an ordinance to address this, this is not going to go away.
No.
That's why I think it's really important to explore keeping it internally in terms of homeowners associations, because that's where the money, you know, is needed. I thought of it more as a sliding scale for folks rather than what was described for Greenbridge. But I think the first step is to ask folks, to the developer, to explore that, because I think it's really important for the town of Carlborough to see condos being available. And if we start messing with the ordinance, you know, we're backing ourselves into a corner as far as payment in lieu. And every developer will come to us with the same kind of concerns about maintenance for homeowners associations.
I need to correct one thing, Mr. Mayor, if I could, just for the record. The transfer fee funds at both Greenbridge and East 54 will be controlled by the land trust.
The transfer funds will.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I was wrong.
At this point, we do have one other person signed up. So just on the off chance that he's got this whole thing figured out, I'm going to call on Gary Cramling to come up and...
No dice.
Well, then sit back down. No.
I'm Gary Cramling. I'm a resident of Carlborough. I first wanted to say that by being a resident of Carlborough, I kind of see affordable housing as my problem, as it is our municipality's problem, as it is developers' problem who want to develop here, that this is something that we need to solve together. And so the idea of homeowners association fees that are subsidized by the other market rate units in a building seems perfectly reasonable to me. That's other people who choose to call Carlborough home subsidizing those people who don't have the means but want to live here. And people want to live in Carlborough partly because of the diversity that's here. So the idea of basing HOA fees on a sliding scale or using this transfer fee, I think, is a perfectly reasonable means of going about bringing affordable housing to Carlborough. Having said that, I certainly empathize with the applicant in terms of the very, very high costs of bringing affordable housing units to these type of mixed-use buildings in town. When this affordable housing requirement, or I guess it's not a requirement, was written into the land use ordinance, I don't think we really had an idea of what these buildings would be, how costly they would be, and certainly how much land in downtown was going to become. I've looked at a lot of these numbers myself, and based on the price of land, the price per square foot to put up these buildings, and part of the reason they're so expensive is they do include a commercial component, and that absolutely adds to the price even for the residential units. And also for parking, whether you have surface parking, above-ground structured parking, or, God forbid, you actually have to put parking underground, it is insanely expensive to do. So to provide that parking for affordable units on top of the market rate units just causes costs to escalate, really, where projects become unfeasible. Or if they remain feasible, the only way they do is if you have 15% affordable units and you have 85% very, very high-end luxury units. And I really want the board to hear that with this policy as it's written, with these types of buildings, there is a huge chasm that's developing between what we're providing in terms of affordable housing and what type of other housing we're providing. I've heard people critical of a lot of the luxury condominium units that are coming in, whether it be in Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And I'm not here to defend the developers out there. In general, providing higher-end units does provide more money to a developer. But also, in a lot of cases, there's no option that to provide these types of affordable units with structured parking what it is, the land price what it is, and the construction costs what they are, it's what you have to provide. So I wanted to say that, too. Having said that, I wanted to show you one thing really quickly. If someone could help me put something on here. I definitely support, I think a lot needs to be done with affordable housing as it relates to these mixed-use buildings in town. I think prices in the 150, 200, 250 range, you're not going to see a lot of those anymore unless you just have a postage stamp-sized unit. Because you can't affordably provide those and then also provide these units for $75,000. To give you an example, this is a spreadsheet. Let's see if the focus is far as that's all right.
You can zoom in on it too, can't you?
I've been looking at this issue myself. This is a spreadsheet I put together, which actually has been blessed by the staff at Orange Community Housing and Land Trust. And what it does is it breaks down based on 80% median and 70% median. Whether there's one, two, three, or four-person household, just how much income this person has, and then 30% of that income can be devoted to housing costs. And then those housing costs are broken down into taxes, the HOA fee, the stewardship fee back to that organization. There shouldn't be insurance for the condominiums. And then you are left with an amount of money that can be applied to a mortgage. Now, I specifically put in $300 here, or times 12, $3,600 for an HOA fee. And you could see really quickly that the price for a one-bedroom unit and a two-bedroom unit and a three-bedroom unit drops considerably. So on a per-square-foot basis, this is very, very little money that is being given the developer for these units. In contrast, using a sliding scale, which, as you mentioned, Greenbridge is doing, and using a transfer fee like Roger Perry with East West Partners is doing at East 54, now you can see, even though on average we're using $300 a month as a fee for these affordable units, because we're using a sliding scale, that number drops considerably. And the reason it drops considerably, if you look down here, is for these market rate units, based on the price that these units are selling for, their numbers are going up slightly. And this is all based on the percentage of units that you put in your development. So now you see these numbers are up to 100, 115, and 130. So the developer is getting more from this organization for their units. And the reason they can get more is because the market rate folks are helping to subsidize those units. I'm not saying this is a perfect solution, but I'm saying this is something other developers are doing. And until we work out a little bit better system with affordable housing, and in my opinion, be more inclusive of people above this $100,000 range, it's the best we got. But I don't see any difference between this particular applicant and their project and any other project.
Thanks for a very thorough analysis, Gary.
Gary, could you give that chart to the clerk so she can get copies of us?
Yep.
Thank you.
Well, as Gary just said, as I was just saying earlier,
there is a way to do it.
Yeah. I think what this illustrates is that this is a constantly evolving the science, or art, if you will. It's more art than science, really, as Robert can attest. And so there's not a single silver bullet, and we're always going to have to look for innovation every time this issue comes up, or y'all will.
So you can come and comment.
$200 an hour, sweetheart. At any rate, that's my suggestion, that we ask them to go back and work on that mechanism.
We developed this ordinance to meet a community need. And the community need, as we all know, is for affordable housing. I would like us to be able to have the flexibility to address that need in different ways depending on the current situation. What we're hearing from Robert loud and clear now, and he's too polite to shout or he would, is that they have, either on the ground or in the pipeline, enough condos for the time being, for probably quite a bit of time being, and that it's costing them money that they do not have, that the community does not have, to keep people in those condos, and that they will be forced to have some folks living in the condos that maybe aren't who we're going to address. We have an opportunity here to provide some money to keep the condos that are already in existence both affordable and maintained so that they will be able to be resold without costing the community a great deal of money. I, too, as everybody in this room, we all want and work for economic integration within the community. But at different times, we have to give different weight to our goals. And right now, I think the most important thing as far as affordable housing goes, where our expert is telling us over and over again, is to take care of the units that we have and that could be coming down the line. By allowing this project to make a payment in lieu of $90,000 for each of the units, we are going some distance, not all the distance that Robert needs, but we would be able to keep affordable and to keep resaleable units that either exist now or will soon exist. And so for that reason, I would support, in this particular case, the acceptance of payment in lieu, because I think it is it's the reasonable thing to do at the moment.
Joel, and then Alex.
I'm going to have to disagree with you on this one. I think it is reasonable that if there is some sort of legal mechanism to do what they did in Greenbridge, then I think they should do it here. One of my concerns is that we continue to see, wherever they are, because this doesn't necessarily, may not just apply downtown, if I understand it. It's a citywide ordinance. So it may apply in other areas. And one thing we do know is that there's a limited amount of land to develop property as a whole for either residential or commercial. Because, as Gary said, you know, Carver is a very popular place to live. So my concern with payment in lieu is that we'll get payment in lieu but have no place to put it. And so that's a long-term concern of mine. And I think if there is a vehicle the way we could do it, then I think I'm for the strategy and the legal restrictions they use for Greenbridge and East 54. Now, one thing I will say is if the board has more data about what else is left and where it could be put, and we have some idea, this is what's been developed and this is what's left, both downtown and all throughout Carrboro, then I think we could make a more refined decision mm-hmm. about what goes on the ground everywhere. And so I'm not yet willing to accept payment in lieu quite yet. You're moving me toward it more, but in this instance, if there is a legal mechanism to do it, then I'd probably support more the transfer fee mechanism. And I would ask, you know, staff in 2008 as opposed to 2007, you know, I don't know.
Your attorney's got his finger up.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
I just want to help perhaps to frame this issue as it's discussed, because the question is not whether under the existing ordinance, whether the town or the board chooses to accept a payment in lieu or not. The existing ordinance gives them that opportunity to make a payment in lieu. The existing ordinance gives them the right to make to establish for affordable units and get the density bonus. But what I heard is a young say is that the developer is probably, I think she phrased it as, has no incentive to make a payment in lieu without getting an affordable unit in return for that, which the ordinance doesn't provide. So I think the kind of the if there is an issue of what the board is to authorize, so to speak, it would be whether you would move in the direction of amending the ordinance to allow a payment in lieu to be provided and get the bonus unit, just as if you provided for the bonus unit. But right under the existing ordinance, it's not a question of whether you wish to accept the payment in lieu. If they want to make a payment in lieu and not get an affordable unit, the ordinance provides them that opportunity. It provides that they can meet the 15% goal by doing that. They just don't get an affordable unit for what? For that. I'm sorry, they don't get to build a market rate unit by making that payment, but they currently have the right to get the density bonus by building the market rate unit.
Alex, and then Randy, and then me.
Basically, Mike just said what I was going to say in a really complicated way. Do you guys get it?
Yep.
What's on the table is whether they get the bonus unit.
That's right.
Okay.
And if there's a way, again, to utilize this other mechanism, which can won't completely solve but help address some of Robert's capacity issues or getting the units on the ground, I think it should be explored before anybody drops the hammer down and goes, this is what I'm bound and determined to support or not support and all that crap.
Right, and that's exactly where I was going with it, because I think that Carrboro is poised for... I mean, we've got nascent new urbanism going on, and I think it's really important to have pursue as many possibilities to address this that we can before we lock ourselves into a mindset of how payments in lieu will be used.
So I'm not sure whether what I'm about to say goes along with what Alex was just saying or not, but... You know, I'm struck. I think I share Joel's reservations about these situations where we, you know, one at a time are presented with case-by-case decision-making about payments in lieu and this type of thing. And it puts us in an uncomfortable position because it sort of opens the door a crack to the possibility that it has something to do with who's asking. That is to say, we need to have an objective policy that says, you know, this is how it's going to work every time, or every time that the situation is this way. And I feel like we have as far as it goes, our payment in lieu policy is a good policy, but that it may not be going as far as it needs to in order for us to meet a bunch of other affordable housing goals that we have as a community. I want to suggest that maybe two members of the board and some of our town staff and Robert Dowling could maybe sit down and try to think through a proposed set of different policies that would give us some that would allow us to make some objective decisions about when we do or do not accept payment in lieu, and that might have a little bit greater degree of flexibility than what our policy is right now. And I would be willing to volunteer, and I'd also be willing to draft Alex into that. to maybe get together and try to
work for free. Huh?
Okay. Well, yeah, all I got to do is get it in before December 5th or so.
I'll do it with this little proviso, which is that I hear what you're saying. I think that it's important for us to try to develop some system by which we do this consistently. On the other hand, what we're seeing is that each set of circumstances tends to be unique enough that it requires a unique solution every time. So we don't want to put ourselves in too much of a box.
I follow you.
I mean, I don't object to the direction you're going, but with that caution, I would just say.
Yeah, and I don't know whether it would be a set of, I don't know whether what I'm imagining would be a set of, like, hard and fast rules, or whether it be a set of criteria that would be used in making these decisions or something like that, but something that would allow us to... Dan and then Joel.
Yeah, well, I am going to object to what you want to do, because I'm not convinced that we need to expand our use of payment in lieu, which we just established. And I think, I mean, I'm not unalterably against, I'm against doing it now in the manner you suggest. I think that if you want to pursue that we should have some work session time to talk about it as a board and really get our ideas out as a group as to what we think. I mean, I want, you know, when I hear this discussion tonight, I want affordable units downtown. You know, I don't want our affordable units only going where there are going to be townhouses or single-family houses going. In downtown, we're going to get condominiums. I want affordable there, and it looks like we have the possibility of a mechanism that can get us that. So my feeling is that this other discussion may be premature, but I'm willing to have it. But I'd like to be part of it, and I'd like to have the benefit of all of our input on that from the standpoint of policy.
Well, let me clarify that. I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that, this subject is sort of expansive enough and complex enough that I kind of think it would be helpful to have some specific ideas on the table for the board to give some reaction to. And I'm fine with that maybe the next step after what I've suggested would be then that we would have that type of work session discussion so that we could, you know, either tear to shreds whatever ideas Alex and I might come up with, or narrow them down to maybe something more specific. But I'm just, my feeling is that every time we talk about this, I hear the same key points, which are that we're going to need a whole bunch more subsidy, that the current policy only provides for some very limited circumstances where payments in lieu go into the trust fund, and that we all want the housing, you know, somehow the conversation has to kind of move beyond those three points.
Well,
Joel, and then
one of the things that when you're looking at a policy, and I guess the data that I would ask for when you're looking at it, because that would inform some of the decisions that I would be considering for policy, is when we look at the town, it's sort of a response to, you know, do we all want them townhomes, somewhere where they're just developing new property, or where is the affordable housing that's controlled by the land trust and the habitat, and then what's left? Because I think that's a kind of a key idea of payment in lieu, because I don't want to be in a situation 10 years down the road when Carver is still going to be popular, no matter what happens, I think. And so then you will have this natural increase, because when you look at the economics and the popularity of Carver, and, you know, we have a 4.8 increase in property values. Other people are seeing that deceleration, and we haven't seen it yet. Now, I don't know what's going to happen with the economy. Just but wait. Let's assume for a moment that we're going to do between a 2 and a 4% increase. So that means whatever's left, because we're not going in the watershed and we're not going in the world buffer. We have made that decision, and I'm not saying that we should change that. Then there's just a limited amount of property where things can go down. And so when you look at that, you've got to make the decision about what's left and what's on the ground, because that will inform your decision, because there's going to be a limit.
I hate to stop everybody, but we're sort of spilling over into the overarching policy discussion here.
I'm sorry.
And I think the point that Dan raised a little earlier, and I'm not trying to yank the rug out from under you, Mark, but I think we ought to stay away from the general policy discussion until we've actually finished working this problem.
Okay.
On this issue, I guess my basic view is that while it may be messy, as long as we end up with a satisfactory solution, let's just kind of leave it be.
Okay.
And if we hit a wall where we wind up with an unsatisfactory solution, or can't, or don't seem to be able to, if we get stuck, then go back to revisiting the larger policy issues. But again, we've got a substantial mechanism here, which we haven't even thrown into the mix to try to arrive at a solution to work this particular problem. So let's throw those guys back in the Cuisinart, turn it on, see what comes out at the back end, and if we don't have a satisfactory solution, well, then we clearly need to have a broader discussion.
Jackie?
Yeah, at the risk of ruining my well-crafted image, I really want to make sure that we're being pragmatic here, because what we're hearing from Robert is that they have 106 units either in existence or coming online of condos, and that the people who can buy those condos are a very narrow group of people, and sometimes the people who fit that profile are not the folks always who we would like. In many, many cases, in the vast majority of cases, they are serving people who are truly low income. By having all these condos, this one type of housing with these costs on it, we're narrowing the window and putting ourselves as a community in the position where we're serving a very narrow group of people who, in many cases, will be having increased incomes over who are beginning their careers and who are going to be making more money. I don't want us to flood the market with affordable condominiums at the expense of existing housing stock and at the expense of, we could do some non-condominiums. We could do some apartments. It's not the Housing Corporation's responsibility, but I'd like to see some money go towards the Housing First project. So let's be really careful what were the unintended consequences of what we could lock ourselves into.
What I'm suggesting is that by having this conversation now, where we're getting locked into certain positions before exploring all the options that are available to us, that we're actually limiting it. We don't know what's going to come out on the back end.
I think what I'm saying is that if you and Mark are sitting down to talk about this and to come to the board with something, that I know the idea that I'm presenting is not one that you two have, and I would like that to be in the mix of things discussed, because I think it's important to be considered.
Okay. It will be. I'm certain it will be. And I agree with the point you're making earlier, Alex, that I am talking about a, you know, sort of bigger picture issue, and it doesn't necessarily do anything to resolve this issue. And I actually think that maybe some of the board members missed that point. That is to say, I'm not sure that I'm inclined to do anything about this present situation. I don't know that we need to have a whole lot more discussion about it. There are some ways that this development could find a way to incorporate the affordable housing component in it, and I think that needs to be explored. But I think there is this other larger issue of, you know, we're looking at $1 million worth of subsidy to go into just a couple of projects that have already been approved in Carrboro, and the prospect of quite a few more projects that will be coming down the line. And you know, we can try to get home program money or non-entitlement CDBG or something along those lines in terms of federal funds to go into these projects, but if the projects that people are contemplating right now are indeed mostly going to come to fruition, we're really, you know, we're not going to be able to go back to the home program well for the entire solution to the problem. You know, there's just not enough money in the home program to do it. And I don't, you know, this board has never been expressed an interest that I've heard in asking local taxpayers in Carrboro to dip into their pockets to support direct subsidization of affordable housing, and I don't anticipate that we're about to start that. So there's got to be the risk that we run. I want to emphasize this point. The risk that we run is that if, when those units come online, the necessary subsidy isn't there, so that the range of incomes that Robert could potentially, that the housing trust, the land trust could potentially sell to, there's either a very narrow range of incomes, extraordinarily narrow range of incomes, or a negative range of incomes that is becomes actually impossible, and his staff can't sell the units, then the units end up going back to the developer and get sold as market rate units. It depends on exactly what the CUP says, but that's how it's been. That's what's been approved for Ballantyne, for example. Yeah. That those units will that just turns into a bonanza for the developers at Ballantyne. That they get to just sell those units as market rate units and make an extra couple $100,000 on their deal. Well, nobody at this table wants to let that happen, but we've got to look seriously at how we're doing the payment in lieu stuff, because at some point, not to try and segregate the affordable housing to one particular type of housing or one part of town, but because, hey, if you take all housing and never any payment in lieu, then there's going to have to be a big additional funding source coming in that is not any of the existing state or federal programs. That's really the problem. Seems to me.
Okay. With that, just to try to put some end to this,
please.
I'm going to move that we ask the applicant to sit down with staff and Robert, if you're willing, to explore the internal subsidy mechanism that's been used in some of the more recent projects, and to ask the applicant to return to us, and perhaps Robert to return to us with a recommendation for some ideas about how we may or may not proceed. Because we've already got memo number one, so with this additional bit of education, maybe we can get memo two and figure out some hybrid that can meet the policy goals, keep Robert from drowning, and get us moving forward.
Second that.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded that we do all that stuff that Alex just said. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed. The matter passes unanimously.
Thanks, guys.
No, she's voted.
No, I'm sorry.
The 6-1.
matter passes 6-1.
Mark?
Yeah.
I have two additional comments now that that's done. One is just to Steve. If this works out, or even if it seems like it could work out with this, let's call it Greenbridge model, it seems like that's something that whoever in planning is presenting the affordable housing model to a developer who's coming and doing condos should, of course, be familiar with that in the future and able to share that with the developer as they come in. And then to you all, that, you know, I guess at some point we will have a broader discussion about affordable housing in various dimensions. And one thing I'd like us to talk about when we get back to that, I'll wait, is the point that Gary raised, which I think is an important point about the housing gap beyond what the land trust could handle. And, you know, starting at 120, and I don't know if it goes up to 250 or maybe even 300 now, but somewhere in there where the housing, you know, the prices are going out of those range, and, of course, nothing's being built in that range, that I think we need to look at how we get some housing in that range as well. And obviously it's not going to be land, not, it's not going to be this land trust, Roberts Land Trust, that deals with that. It may be some other land trust or some other mechanism, but I'd like that to be part of the discussion.
Could we possibly ask Gary if he could sit in on some of those meetings and share his expertise with us if he's willing to? Are you willing to
sure.
do that, or did I just?
If he's,
I didn't
if he's
a volunteer
available.
Well,
that's a danger. You walk into this room and you walk out with a job, boys and girls.
There you go.
I'm
paid. Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. We're going to take a 3-minute break at this point, 4 1/4-minute break, and we'll be right back after that.
Yeah.
That was the longest 4 1/4 minute break ever. Good evening and welcome back. We are on agenda item D2, request for traffic calming on Oak Avenue. Mr. Manager.
The residents of Oak Avenue have submitted a petition under the town's residential traffic management plan requesting traffic calming between Weaver Street and Poplar Avenue. Staff recommendation and the Transportation Advisory Board recommendation are provided below. Staff has provided a resolution for consideration by the Mayor, Board of Aldermen, and Adina Messinger has a brief presentation for the board.
Good evening. I will certainly try to make this brief. As Steve mentioned, this is regarding the request for traffic calming on the 100 and 200 block of Oak Avenue, which is highlighted in the red over here. This petition was initiated in March, again, following the guidelines exactly as they're written in the residential traffic management plan. This initiated some data collection. The data collection began in March, where we did some traffic counts, and then the pedestrian and bike counts were conducted in the end of April and beginning of May. This was compiled so that the staff could complete the criteria sheet, which I put in front of y'all this evening. And staff reviewed the sheet and made an initial recommendation that was then given to the Transportation Advisory Board for review and their recommendation in June. In the meantime, during July and September, additional data was collected because staff wanted to see if there was a particular influence of the Carver Elementary School and sort of the cycle of that school and how that might impact what's going on as far as the volume and speed of traffic. What we ended up finding was that there really was no influence, and all the data came out pretty much the same from March, July, and September. But we did want to take a look at that. Staff then reviewed, again, this initial data and made a recommendation, and that brings us to this evening for your consideration. This over here just graphically shows what the results of the data collection were. There is, let's see if I can figure out the laser, but there were three locations where the speed and traffic counts were taken along this section. Over here was one of them where you see there's a 24.1 mile per hour is the 85th percentile speed. This location that was 26.5 miles per hour, and down here is 25 miles per hour, and this street is posted at 20 miles per hour. For the daily volume, and again, this did not really change from March to September to July, you're looking at about 570 vehicles per day that are traveling along this particular section of Oak Avenue, with two-thirds of that traffic traveling southbound and one-third traveling northbound. We have also, we sort of collected the AM and PM peak. You can see the volumes over there. And what this does is it allows us to decide when we need to go out and take our bike and pedestrian counts. And so the results of that, again, averaging what we saw, was that there's about 8 pedestrians in the AM and also the PM peak hour. And for the bicycles, you've got about 7 and 5 for the AM and PM, respectively. So compiling all this data into that criteria sheet, what it does is it places this particular street really at the edge of Stage 1 and Stage 2 traffic calming. It's a pretty close race over here. We presented this data to the Transportation Advisory Board and also the Traffic and Parking Committee, which is made up of various departments from the staff. And each of those groups have made a recommendation. The staff recommendation is to stick with the Stage 1 traffic calming, which would include enforcement and education. It would also include really trying to look at their neighborhood as more than this particular part of Oak Avenue and try to figure out an overall residential traffic management plan for this neighborhood. This third bullet, which talks about the intersection of Oak and Greensboro, kind of makes a little more sense when you'll see the TAB recommendation, but While this is not in the particular location of this request, it did come up when we looked at this and when we discussed this that really is not a very pedestrian-friendly intersection. And there was an interest in trying to see what could be done to narrow it down a bit. It is used by the school buses, so we have to take that into consideration, but we do want to sort of see what might be able to be done to make that intersection a little bit better. For the TAB's recommendation, they did recommend that a speed table be implemented, and the next slide will sort of show where a preliminary look at where that might go along the street. They did recommend that the speed table that would be put in would kind of be similar to those at Lake Hogan Farms, but I think in your packets, staff did respond to that particular request, and that if the consideration is to put in a speed table, that it would be in the fashion along High Street due to the fact that this is not a collector street and there's no sidewalk connecting it, and those speed tables serve really also as crosswalks. The TAB also wanted the town to look at possibly doing some sort of textured surfacing along the edges and the entrances of this particular area of Oak Avenue. And again, this is where they brought up this issue of the Oak and Greensboro intersection. This is just an image of where a speed table might go if that is the decision. This location was looked at with the assistance of folks from Sungate, just kind of get a feel for where one might be able to be put in, given that it needs to be a certain distance from the Weaver Street and the Poplar Avenue intersections, as well as, you know, you don't want to interrupt anybody's driveway. You want to be respectful of people's frontages, as well as there's a curve in the road, there's a manhole as well. So, but that was the preliminary location of where it might go. And the request that is before you this evening is to accept the staff recommendation, which is provided in Attachment A.
Joel, I think we have a number of people after you, but we have a number of people who want to speak.
Okay, just one question. The speed table different. Could you, is it the texture of the top of the speed table?
Yeah.
As opposed to a little, I guess my best description is rougher than, say, a speed table that's just kind of, that has, my best description is more sharp edges in terms of, I guess I can draw it better, but more of a square at the top and then sloping on the down as opposed to the textured is a little more rounded.
Right. I think the ones on High Street are the ones that are a little bit more rounded. The ones in Lake Hogan Farms do have that table look to it, so it's a bit flatter.
Okay. That's all my questions.
And what was recommended by the Transportation Advisory Board was the flatter top?
Correct.
Kind? Okay. Dan?
Steve, on item 4 in the recommendation where it says, as such time as funding is available, am I correct in interpreting that to mean that we don't have the $2,500 for that speed hub in this year's budget?
I believe, and George, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe if the board chose to go with a speed table or hump or whatever, you might determine, I think we would have the $2,500 in this year's budget.
We would.
Is that correct, George?
Okay, so we could. Okay, great.
Potentially, okay. I see a number of Oak Avenue residents here. Do some of you want to speak on this subject? All right.
Well,
yeah.
My name's Chris Frank, and I live on the corner of Oak Avenue and Evans Court. It'd be nice to see the graphic up there. But anyway, the staff's recommendation puts us at the cusp of stage one and stage two. And I think that the error in their calculations of the numbers is that they classify us as a collector street because we are a street that does run between two more major streets. But that classification is given to us just by where it's located, not by its actual capacity. If any new streets were made that were collector streets, they'd have to be 27 feet wide with sidewalks on both sides. This street doesn't even meet the specifications for a local street. So I think, you know, scoring it as a collector, I think that's an error. And it is a special, there are special things happening here in that there is a curve there. Mm-hmm. Right where people are going the fastest. There's a driveway right there coming out of that property there, which belongs to the Nestors. That's Jack Nestor and Arlene Furman there. As you can see, she's visually impaired, and so it's very scary for her to walk out in the street every day. And then as to the recommendations from the staff, first off, I noticed in one of her first slides the timeline. Data collection, staff review, TAB meeting, then data collection, staff review. It looks like those looked the same to me, like they were doing it again, even after it had been done, although I understand that they wanted to collect some more data. But the recommendations, additional enforcement, I think that's always great anywhere, but I don't think you're going to park a police car down there on a regular basis and really help us very much with that. Neighborhood awareness, the problem isn't people in the neighborhood, it's people out of the neighborhood. As you can see, that the traffic southbound, twice as many, it's a cut through. People do it to cut through because they're in a hurry. The third one, narrowing the intersection, as has been pointed out, with the bus traffic in there, that may be hard to do, and I don't think that would help slow people down at our end at all. It was just something that was talked about at the meeting. And then the traffic management plan, to conduct a traffic management plan, that just looks to me like pushing something off to the next administration. And I just hope that you guys can show us government in action tonight by helping us out on this issue. So
I have a question for Chris. The two kinds of devices that were offered, the two tables, one uh-huh. that's more like rounded one on High Street, the other more like tabletop with the skirted sides that they have at Lake Hogan Farms. Is there a preference by folks who live in and around Oak?
I don't. It hadn't come up, Bobby, and I just assumed that whatever that you folks would design thought would be the right kind of a calling device would be what we would use. I just have one more suggestion as to this. No matter what you do. That I recommend that I know there's some problems with textured pavement as was in the your attachments there, but I think a good idea that would be really cheap that would be helpful is to put stripes along the side of each side of Oak Avenue like is on Poplar Avenue, because it perceptually moves people to the center of the road and makes them think the road is narrower, and that will help, and also people that are walking there and kids riding their bikes and stuff kind of know to stay over to that site and not wander out into the center. But anyway, I think even with this, the calming device, that we should consider doing that. So.
Yeah, that's an excellent suggestion. I biked on that road. It is very narrow.
It is in the curve. And
let's, George, can you come up real quick?
Excuse me, George Size, Public Works Director. I just want to make some clarification. Don't want to contradict what Adina mentioned, but the tables that we put on High Street also have a flat area. The difference between that and what's Lake Hogan's Farm is those are texture because there is a crosswalk. But the ones on High Street, the newer ones that we have put in, have a 6-foot length taper and a 10-foot flatter area on top. Just to clarify that, so that's what
okay. So the main difference, the main difference between Lake Hogan Farms and High Street is
the texture
on the top.
Yes. Okay. Some of the older ones were more rounded, but the newer ones that we're installing are more emergency vehicle friendly, and we have the ability to install the flatter tops now also. So that's what we're doing.
I see. Okay. Were there other folks who wanted to speak on this issue? Arlene, come on up.
My name's Arlene Furman, and I'm at 203 Oak, and that is right on the curve. And I moved to Carrboro because of my disability. And so every time I step out of my driveway, I have to be really careful because the cars, and actually what Chris said about the having the, you know, walking lane, bike lane would be great, because those cars come and they're right at our driveway. So I would really appreciate something to be done, because every day it's, you know, somebody's...
It's exciting.
Yeah.
It's exciting. I'm Jack, her husband. And actually the proposed, you know, the red square there, that's right at the edge of our driveway, which would be fine.
Right.
And, you know, if there's any cost differences, you don't need a crosswalk type, you know, because it's, it's a short walk to the next curb.
Yeah. Okay. But we wouldn't feel like it would be an infringement in front of our house or driveway.
Okay.
Thanks,
Ray. Great.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Yep.
I'm sorry, could I just one question? Do you have an opinion, I guess, on the textured, because there in the information from the staff discussion, they were saying that textured pavement can be problematic for the visually impaired. And so...
I don't think I know the difference, actually. I would have to be taken to a texture to see if it, you know, was a problem.
Okay. Thanks.
But thank you.
All right. Is there anybody else from who wants to speak on this item? No, I'm not saying y'all have to now.
Thank you for the time. We don't want to keep you any later than necessary to make our points, I guess. And I would first and foremost say that safety is our major concern. I would also say I could represent the elderly, having had a very old dog that would take a half hour to walk that block, and there were a frequency of at least once a week where we would be trying to jump into the curb to avoid a car and a bicyclist and a pedestrian all trying to come together around that curb or in that block. I really think that the issue of a public awareness campaign is certainly important for all of downtown and the neighborhoods. So I wouldn't restrict it just to our block or just to Oak Avenue if we're going to do something like that. But it's not an issue of the residents. We're all very conscientious and concerned about each other's safety. I would hope that $2,500 is not cost prohibitive for the town, and that you would see whatever we do in Oak Avenue and this area so close to downtown as being a model for what can be done in other areas, because I think the goal of this board and all of us is to have a very livable, walkable downtown development and neighborhood community, and so this is the beginning of what we're going to need to do in our communities. I personally would also be in favor of the planters and something more innovative, and I think you could get neighbors being willing to take care of those kinds of things. I personally would contribute my time for that. So I think there's lots of opportunities. We really urge you to go forward. We've been living with this speed issue for a long time, and it's very dangerous. The 85th percentile doesn't show you the people who, and the other statistics you have available do show, there are people going 40, 50, and 60 miles an hour down Oak Avenue in that one block. It seems hard to believe you could get up to that kind of speed in one block, but you can't, and that's what we're facing. So thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Sherman.
Jackie.
Hi. There had been some talk, Transportation Advisory Board, I think, of putting some textured entrances at both ends. What would you think of that? I trust your aesthetic more than many people.
Well, I don't want to speak for even the small representatives that are here, but I would be in favor of both ends of the street having something. I mean, I think it's a major area for people to walking, biking, riding. So, you know, I think it would help on both ends, really, not just a room for a whim.
My feeling with the texture at both ends would be that it would kind of delineate it as...
You're entering a neighborhood.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You're coming into a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Alex.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to go ahead and put something together. As is often the case with the traffic management plan studies, they often sort of fall right on the cusp. And it's sort of traditional for us to err on the side of the neighborhood's request. when that happens. So what I would suggest is that we take both staff's recommendation. Actually, pinching down the intersection at North Greensboro is a really good idea. The reason being that it's angled in such a way that it functions like an off-ramp. I mean, guilty, I've done it, you know, just whip on in there, and you're really going a lot faster than you thought because, you know, you're coming down South Greensboro and you're doing 35, and you're still doing 35 when you sail up the little ramp in front of, you know.
Because you can.
Yeah, because you can. You only realize you're going too fast when you you hit Catherine and Berkeley's house and go, shit, there's that, you know. So I think that's a really worthwhile step to take. Second, I think it's perfectly reasonable to go ahead and put a speed table as identified in the staff presentation using the high street design, not using the texture. Right. I got to warn everybody, I understand your interest in putting textured pavement at either end, but that stuff is noisy as hell. Oh. And so the folks at either end of the street probably would want to, you know, check that out before putting
it down.
Well,
let's see how the speed bumps work, and if they don't work, then maybe we can textured entrances or something.
On the striping issue, that works on Poplar because it's a one-way. This is a two-way. So I'm not sure how well that would work. We could ask George to take a look at it.
I would support that
because I think it
gives the visual delineation. That is not a sidewalked street, and
right.
I think that helps.
Yeah. I mean, I think we just want to hear from George about how that's going to work, because while we put the striping down on Poplar, those are not actual legal pedestrian or bike lanes
right. Because
they're not wide enough. They don't fit the criteria, and there are whole liability issues and all that stuff.
Okay.
So,
but
I mean, one could go ahead and stripe it as an informal as a visual suggestion,
right.
If you will. But just to be honest
about
that.
Well, if we look into it,
yeah.
I think that if staff looks into it, at least.
Yeah, should we go ahead and just do these two things for starters, and then just ask George to come back with some recommendations on the other?
Because I think striping does slow you down. It says, here's like the edge of the street, you know?
Sure, I don't have any objection to it. I just don't want to direct staff to do something kind of half-assed.
Without them having the
opportunity
to give us their professional.
So I'll move the resolution with the following addition. I'm just shuffling it around a little bit. 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it says all users of Oak Avenue. I'm talking about the public awareness campaign, so that implies the entire downtown. And what I'm doing is substituting 4, a speed table be erected as identified in the staff presentation using the high street design. I guess if you all want to, we could start putting together an overall traffic management plan for the neighborhood. Do you want to do that or not?
I just want to slow people down.
Okay.
We need to see what this
does. So 1, 2, 3, and 5.
Right.
Just real quickly, George just whispered in my ear.
Mm-hmm.
For number 3, the narrowing, it'd be fine if you all direct looking at that, but George tells me that's about a $25,000 project potentially. We do not have money set aside for
that. We're only
going to
look at that.
Okay. Just want to be
go right.
Yeah, it says endorses.
Okay.
And then, you know, we could see if we could troll up some enhancement money, because it's right. It's at a DOT intersection.
Right. It is.
So we might be able to troll up some cash.
And do you have stripes in there as well?
Or somebody can troll up some cash.
Anyway,
number 4 is just substituting the speed table.
Okay.
That's it.
Are you not going to
look at the stripes?
A new number 5, ask staff to explore striping as discussed, and that's it.
Second.
Okay. That's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed? That are passed unanimously.
Let us know how it works, gang.
All right. Yeah.
Come back.
Grassroots organizing in action. There you go.
They even had the mayor out collecting signatures on the petition.
Yeah.
All right. We have a request from the staff that I'm sorry. Are there any other matters from the town staff?
Just the one I
request for.
Right. Okay.
executive session. Are there any matters from the board?
Yeah, I have something, which is just to throw into the planning hopper, which is at our last meeting, we looked at, I think we had one project where out of 100 specimen trees, 85 were being removed, and another out of 18 specimen trees, a dozen were being removed. And I'd like to look at, and I understand that to build something, you have to remove trees. But I'd like to look at the possibility of some mechanism whereby we could have those trees replaced, if not on that site, elsewhere in the community. So perhaps it would be a tree fund on a tree-per-tree basis. My understanding is that trees are not very expensive, and there's certainly plenty of people in town who'd like to plant them. So, you know, if it, at some point you all could take a look at that, or, you know, something along those lines, so that we can keep up our tree infrastructure performance.
Are you ready to close?
No, I have
one item, too. Go ahead.
I just want to know, we had all brought up a couple weeks ago wanting to have a agenda item dealing with changing our development ordinance to include, like, alternatives to grass in new developments, and to talk about that. Is that coming up anytime soon?
It's pertinent.
I understand it's pertinent. Also understand that most of our planning staff has been dealing with trying to wrap up the INSAPERC work, and I don't know, Trish, if you can tell me where we might be with that issue or not.
We haven't started.
I mean, it's...
Okay, just checking.
One statement, one question. The question is regarding Owassa and Stage 2. Is
they're voting on Thursday?
Do we want to say about that so the public is aware?
We'll see what action they take, but I anticipate they're going to, the Owassa board is planning to consider on Thursday whether to go to Stage 2. Water conservation requirements, or declare a stage 2 water shortage, and as I understand it, it's going to reduce further the amount of the types of outdoor watering of plants that are going to be allowed, and further reduce somewhat the maximum amount of water that people are going to be allowed to be consuming. I think it would be helpful for this board or for the Owassa board or someone to adopt some suggested targets for what is an appropriate amount of water for a household to be consuming, and that it's been a little bit confusing that they have listed a maximum number, but that maximum number is still very high and is much higher than most folks would reasonably need. So I don't know. I think it would be appropriate for us to at some point not necessarily in a binding way, but make a suggestion to the public about what an appropriate amount of water is to be using at this point.
Right.
Well, we actually, at our last discussion of this, we came up with the 500 a day figure, which is still quite high, but as I pointed out in an email to you all earlier, is lower than even the stage 3 Owassa limits. And so I think we need to bring
And I guess what I'm trying to get at is I think somewhere on the Owassa website, there's some information about what is really a typical amount of water for a household to be consuming, and that those typical numbers are vastly below even 500.
We did ask citizens of Carrboro to look at reducing their own use by 10% and instituting greater conservation measures. Hopefully folks will do that.
And if I can put it into stark terms, we have at our current consumption rate, we have about like 5.5 months worth of water left, and we have no water at all coming into the system at this point, and no prospect for any significant amount of water to be coming into the system in the next 5.5 months. So we need to you know, the point is going to come very soon where some very severe restrictions are going to have to put in place.
I would like us sometime soon to have a more in-depth water discussion. No pun intended, I'm sorry.
It's
very
shallow right now.
Because there... Cue drip. because there are all kinds of...
Jay-like.
I know, channeling Jay. Anyway, I think it would be a good idea to, you know, long-term, if we go into long-term drought, there are all kinds of implications dealing with growth there. That we need to be talking about.
I think University Lake is 7.3 feet below level.
King Creek's 119 inches below.
Right. Yeah, so. Notably, it's so, as I pointed out on the internet this afternoon, that the water's so low in University Lake that the grass that grows in the mud flat is starting to turn brown.
Yeah.
So
we can use both.
That's low.
An inch a day for 45 days.
And what I don't get is the idea that, oh, well, let's go along using it until it gets really bad. And I'd rather err on the side of, you know, we're still letting people use irrigation systems for their lawns. I don't care if that's efficient. It's
well, stage two will put an end to that.
Right. Stage two does not put an end to that.
No, it does.
No, it doesn't. It says you can use the in-ground irrigation systems as long as you don't use more than half an inch a week. Now, who's going to go around and mention that, measure that half inch? But it says you can still do...
That's not how I read it.
Are we moving towards any policy decision that we're having to make
anyway,
here, or are we just having a coffee table?
Coffee table. More like a water.
We're on our own time. Let's move on.
I just want to remind folks that the Friends Bowling Creek Festival is this weekend. You all come on out. Sunday 1 to 5.
Saturday.
I will personally give a dollar to anybody who can actually find Bowling Creek at this point. Okay. With that, we have a request from the staff to go into executive session to discuss possible criminal activity in town.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. We go into a closed session. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passes unanimously.